Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
And welcome to the New Books in Genocide Studies podcast. In a moment, you'll hear a terrific interview with Thomas Kuhne, author of the recent book, Belonging and Genocide, Hitler's Community, 1918 to 1945. Before we get to that, though, I wanted to take just a moment to say thanks. In the past year, I've posted 16 interviews for the podcast. This wouldn't have been possible without the willingness of authors and editors to take time from their busy schedules to share their insights and research. Likewise, it wouldn't have been possible without the hard work of Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, who edits and posts the interviews, as well as constructing the website for the podcast. As the year ends, I wanted to express my appreciation to all of you who made and make the podcast possible. And I wanted to say thanks to those of you who listen as well. Without you, there would be no reason for the podcast to exist. I'm really excited about what I have planned for the show in the coming year. I've got interviews already recorded or scheduled with Bob Donier, Lasse Hirten, Irvin Staub, and several others. In addition, I'm starting a new occasional series where we look back at a seminal work in the field of genocide studies. We'll discuss that book with the author, as well as with a roundtable of experts who can share with us how that work influenced their own research, what we now know about the subject, and where research in that particular area is headed in the future. I think you'll like what we have planned. If you do, I hope you'll let us know what you found most interesting, and that you'll like us on Facebook. In the meantime, I hope you have a great New Year's season, and that you'll be back to listen to the podcast in 2015. In just a moment, you'll hear my interview with Thomas Kuhne. Skype was not as cooperative as I would have liked during the interview, and there's a low buzz present at times. The sound is not ideal, but it shouldn't be too disruptive, and Kuhne's work and words are fascinating. So I hope you'll stay and listen. I think you'll be glad you did.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Every month or so, I interview an author of a new or recent book in genocide studies. Today, I have the great pleasure of talking with Thomas Kuhne, author of the splendid new book, Belonging and Genocide, Hitler's Community, 1918 to 1945. Published by Yale University Press. In this book, Thomas presents us with a disturbing new understanding of the roots and impact of Nazi crimes before and during the Second World War. The allegiance of many Germans to the Nazi regime stemmed from the powerful sense of community the party and the government crafted. This community satisfied a long-felt need emerging from the perceived anonymity of modern society. But the Nazis intentionally cultivated a sense of community by creating a variety of organizations and experiences designed to heighten a feeling of belonging. And they cemented this community by bonding its members together through the experience of committing crimes. It's a fascinating book with a fascinating thesis, and one we'll get to explore at length in the next 45 minutes. So, with that, Thomas, thanks for being with us on New Books in Genocide Studies, and welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kelly, for inviting me to do this. I'm delighted about this chance, and I very much look forward to our conversation.
Why don't we get started just by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and how you came to be interested in studying the Holocaust?
Well, I was born and raised and actually got my academic training in Germany. And only 11 years ago, I moved to America for primary professional reasons, because I just liked the American academia much better. And that has worked out very well for me. So often people ask me, why do you do the Holocaust? Why do you research the Holocaust? Are there any links in your family or so? Mm-hmm. And I have to say, no, not really. That is not really the reason why I choose that topic. My parents were both born in 1925. My mother was Catholic and my father Protestant. And they, that means they were... my father was drafted to the Wehrmacht, to the army in 1943. So, but they were not really adults adults that could have any impact in the Third Reich. And the same is basically in principle true for my grandparents. They all were pretty ordinary Germans. None of them Nazi, but none of them any heroes of the resistance against the Nazi regime either. So, my parents and their parents kind of muddled through and adjusted. And, that is what millions of other Germans did as well. So that is the private background. But the professional background is that I got in the mid-1990s interested in not so much the Holocaust, but the issues as a scholar, as a historian of masculinities, male bonding, and how that changed over the 20th century. It is something that everyone or many people know, that Germany was a very militaristic country around 1900. The soldier, the officer was, the epitome of a man, what a man represents, and adored by huge parts of the society, the German society at that time. And 100 years later, now, Germany is well known all over the world as a pretty pacifist country, one that shies away from all kinds of military engagements for many reasons, of course. But, there is a strong pacifist sentiment. And the soldier today no longer attracts any kind of adoration any significant part of the society. So there's a fundamental change over the course of the 20th century, and that is a typical problem for a historian. As historians, we want to understand change, and that is what brought me to that topic. I started researching patterns of male bonding, masculinity in the Third Reich, especially among ordinary soldiers. And that topic could not be explored without relating to the Holocaust, into which not only the German elite at that time, but many ordinary Germans were involved as well.
So how did you come to write this book?
This book is the second book that came out of a larger research project. This project on masculinities in the Second World War, the Third Reich, and so on. In the mid-1990s, I started interviewing former Wehrmacht soldiers in Germany. At that time, they were not only alive still, but also, in intellectual and physical shape, so they could be interviewed at that time. This project, and I started reading letters, private letters they wrote during the war, to understand what made them sticking to the army, what made them fighting and so on. And from that project, a German book evolved that was titled Comradeship, the German equivalent to the English word Comradeship. And this book explored what the concept of comradeship meant for German soldiers during the 20th century. The book covers basically the entire 20th century and how the term changed and so on and so forth. And then I moved to America and thought, I have spent so much time on this German project, German book. I think it would be worth to write another book, now English, on it. That focuses the English book about which we are talking now, Belonging and Genocide, does not cover the entire 20th century, but basically the Nazi period with the first chapter on the time before. But the focus is indeed the Nazi period, and especially the time of the Second World War, 1939, the time of the Holocaust. And I wanted to explore in this book why there was never any kind of a serious resistance on a larger scale by Germans against the Nazi regime, why there was no even minor solidarity with the Jews during the Holocaust on any kind of social level. I mean, there was individual resistance and individual solidarity and so on. That is what we know, and that is very important. But there was never any kind of solidarity of groups with the Jews or something. And I wanted to understand why that was so. That is what the book wants to explore.
I'm intrigued. And just to take a brief kind of a parenthetical moment, I guess, before we deal with the book specifically, because I heard you talk about yourself as a historian of gender or a historian of masculinity and a historian of Germany. And yet your title, in some sense, is this, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, I apologize, but Strassler Professor of Holocaust History. And so I wonder if you could say something a little bit about what kind of distinctive sensibilities and approaches that you can bring to the study of the Holocaust and genocide from that perspective or from that background as somebody who comes from a different part of the historical arena.
I would not consider that a different part of the historical arena. I mean, it's indeed true that in the mid-1990s, when I started with this, when these questions came up to me and when I started to work on them as a historian in a scholarly fashion, then I started out as a gender historian, as you may call it, or I would rather say as a historian of masculinities, which is part of gender studies, by no means. Mm-hmm. It comes with this focus. And that is where I started. I have to say, as a historian, I consider myself not distinctively as a gender historian and never have done so. I consider myself as a cultural historian. I want to understand what, in history, how symbolic orders, morals, knowledge and so on, symbolics, rituals of people, how that is, how people make sense of their world, their lives and so on. That is a question of a cultural historian. That is my question. How did people in the Third Reich make sense of what happened, what they did by themselves and so on? And as a cultural historian, I think you still have to, cultural system, culture as a term, it's a vague concept. That is, that does not mean high culture, what we might call high culture, art or music or so, but it relates to what ordinary people felt, thought, and did, and why they did it, why they felt that way, and so on. These things, that is what I consider as cultural history. How people feel about gender orders, masculinity and femininity, or what makes a real man, what makes a woman, and these things, that is part of culture, obviously. That is my focus.
That's a really nice explanation. I was in graduate school in the late 80s and 90s when cultural history really took off, and I think that's a really nice explanation of what cultural history does. So let's turn to the book. You craft your narrative around a German longing for community. So maybe we could just start briefly by asking you to talk about where this longing emerges from, where it started, or what social or cultural or economic developments led to its becoming important in German society.
Well, I think there are two things one should address. One is not a specific German thing, but rather something that you can observe in all modern societies, Western societies, and even beyond. That is around 1800, or in the 18th century, the so-called old regimes, societies that were clearly divided into certain these states or corporations where everyone had his or her place and would not leave it for their entire life. Mm-hmm. This static society fell apart, and it was, you also say, it was torpedoed by liberals and political groups that no longer wanted to live that way. It was also undermined by the rising capitalism and industrial society and so on. Mm-hmm. So it was what happened was around 1800, and then this is a long-term process, went on in the 19th century, that individuals were set free, who no longer were born into a certain part of the society, given part of the society, and so, the state or something, or corporation, like aristocracy or peasantry or the clergy or something like that. So individuals had to choose their place in their societies. And that is something, of course, we are, with this panel today, that's what we are do all the time, and we are used to it. And probably only very few of us would like to renounce of that freedom. But as we all so know, probably most of us, it's sometimes not only a pleasure. It puts quite a lot of pressure on you. You have to make choices, and eventually you are responsible for the choices you make, and you are wholly responsible for these choices one way or another. So that is, it's an ambivalent process. What sociologists call the individualization of societies, which again runs over 200, the last 200, 250 years or so. Around 1900, in many parts of the Western societies, not only in Germany, also in England, in France, in America, and so on, people, and ordinary people, have felt more and more confused about this, or started reflecting on it. Do we want that? What is the price we pay for that, and so on? What are the negative, the downsides of this process? And they started thinking about ways to reconstruct or reestablish or reassure community. Community, a place, a social place, social setting that gives you a sense of belonging, so that you know where you belong. And so. And so that is something that you can observe in many Western societies. In Germany, this process was linked to a more political issue, and that was that Germans thought and wondered about the quality of their nation. Nation building is another phenomenon that runs throughout the entire modernity and shaped especially the 19th century. And there were, you have nations like France or England or America in a way, the US, that found their place as a nation earlier and easier than other parts of the world, and Germany is among those nations which had more problems finding defining themselves as or itself as a nation, because it needed more time. And even if after the German nation, the so-called German Empire, was founded formally, technically in 1871, there were many parts of this country that seemed to drift away or not belong. Apart from that, there was a serious class struggle. Furthermore, class struggle overlapping with religious struggle, denominational struggle, and so on and so forth, regional.
Yes.
So the nation was established, but did not feel as such. That is the point. Did not feel as such. And this deficit was felt by many Germans, also, of course, by intellectuals, sociologists, and so on, politicians. And the concept of the description politicians and demagogues and so on invented was, they would say, we have to recreate, reconstruct, improve our nation in a way that everyone, every German, really feels, has a sense of Germanness. And they called that not nation, but Volksgemeinschaft, people's community. This people's community, everyone should feel, every member of the nation should feel like in a great family, you know, that would, and so on. And that, of course, did not work out easily because in principle it conflicts or contradicts the structure of a modern society where you find your place, where you have your place as a member of a class or a denomination, a religious group or something like that. Yeah? So that, mm-hmm. That was a problem. And now a crucial experience for Germans, as for all other countries, was the experience of the First World War. The First World War initially was welcomed, at least by the educated classes in Germany, as a chance to overcome this fragmentation or segmentation of their own nation. For a moment, it seemed as if all Germans were on the same page, all would feel as Germans, being put in a situation where they have to defend their country, and all would, you know, stick together against these enemies from outside. Mm-hmm. That proved to be an illusion soon after Germans in Germany, just as in other countries, but in particular in Germany, their own class gaps, socialists or the blue-collar workers, versus middle classes and so on, became more visible and powerful than they had been ever before. And that is also the reason why at the end of the war there was a revolution in Germany which swept away the monarchy. And so these class gaps became stronger and stronger. But it seemed to many Germans as if this idea of a harmonious nation overcoming class gaps, religious conflicts, and so on and so forth, had been realized in the trenches, in small soldierly units of the first during the First World War. In a certain way, that was not entirely wrong. In many regards, it was first an illusion and then also simply a propaganda lie. Lie that just silenced down the still existing class and other conflicts in these trenches among soldiers and so on. But nevertheless, in the 1920s, after the war, a powerful movement in Germany developed the idea that the Germans could actually make that old idea of a Volksgemeinschaft, a harmonious nation, real by remodeling the entire German society according to this model of the trench communities, the soldierly, the outlets, the outfits of the units, the small units, battle units, fighting units of the soldiers, in which allegedly there was no class conflict and no other conflicts inside them. Of course, there was with the enemy, but beyond the trenches and so on. As a strong movement, militarist, nationalist movement, not by no means only the Nazis, would say, in a way, it was good that we did have this enemy, the soldier enemy, the enemy, the French or the British, because thanks to the enemy in the trenches as soldiers, we felt as the perfect nation, it gave us a sense of belonging we would not have experienced otherwise. That is a basic idea. That is what happened in the 1920s. And then the Nazis took over in a way. Mm-hmm. They appropriated that idea and developed it further and further.
So you talk about this culture that emerges in Weimar that the Nazis are going to kind of move forward from as one that prioritizes shame over guilt. Can you say what you mean by that?
Well, that is a distinction which I introduced in my book, which indeed may be a little confusing. What I mean by that is, it's basically that I draw... that I learned from anthropologists and also sociologists, mm-hmm. Especially anthropologists who, there was a famous anthropologist in the mid-20th century, Ruth Benedict, mm-hmm. who showed in a book published right after the Second World War that, as she thought, the Japanese society followed a completely different moral system than the American society. And she called this opposition shame culture versus guilt culture. Shame culture means that she applied that to the Japanese society, that people don't follow, as in the Western societies, an inner voice, or, you know, as Westerners, or, you know, in our societies, the highest moral authority is, I mean, God or your super ego, if you don't believe in God, or your conscience, or your things like that. Okay, if you have to make moral decisions, then you do it with yourself, always. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And if you do the wrong thing, take a very bad case, if you murder someone, kill someone, mm-hmm. and it is not revealed, okay? Nobody knows about it. You keep it as a secret. You are not caught. Yeah? Then you, mm-hmm. most people, unless they are, you know, pathologic, still feel guilty. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Bad conscience, pangs of conscience, and so on and so forth. But that is guilt culture. Yeah? That is what the Western model, according to Ruth Benedict. Mm-hmm. And she said that East Asian society, especially the Japanese society, as she examined it, would follow, would not put so much weight on this inner voice, but rather make moral decisions according to what other people would think about them. So the gaze from outside, yeah? Mm-hmm. Whether you as an individual would be shamed, that's shame culture, by doing this or that, by doing wrong, yeah? This distinction of Ruth Benedict is probably problematic because, you know, it creates a dichotomy which in reality does not exist. I mean, even in our current societies, you feel ashamed if you do wrong and so on. So there is a mixture of shame and guilt in all societies, one way or another. But there may be different ratios. And what I wanted to say is in this book, and I basically still think is true, that the Nazis managed to inflate the significance of shame and tried to train Germans in unlearning guilt, to put it in a somewhat simplified way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Nazis never succeeded completely with that program. Mm-hmm. That would not have been possible. You cannot unlearn the morality, the ethical system you grow up with, you know, within a few years or so. That is simply not possible. And the Nazis knew that, but they wanted Germans to ignore or, you know, marginalize as feelings of guilt they might have. You usually have when they murder other people, mm-hmm. or when mm-hmm. they mistreat other people. For instance, their Germans, Jewish fellow citizens. Yeah? So from 1933 on, the Nazis want the Germans to harass them, to boycott them, to exclude them, and so on and so forth. Germans did not follow that line easily, but the Nazis denounced feelings of pity with weak persons and so on. They said, you Germans, you should not feel pity or express pity for people who are not worth. That may be Jews or people with inherited illnesses, which were subject to the so-called euthanasia or Roma and Sinti or homosexuals and so on. These people, the Nazis would say, they do not deserve your empathy, your mercy, your pity. So they want the Germans to unlearn this guilt culture and rather to switch to a shame culture. Mm-hmm. The Nazis did not call that shame culture. The term is a scholarly term, and that needs to be kept in mind. It's a scholarly term. It is not a contemporary term.
Mm-hmm. And you just, so to kind of follow on to that and to talk a little bit about how the Nazis understood the ideal German community they were trying to create, you talk about it as a kind of ethical community, a distinctive understanding of ethics, of how Germans should treat each other and other people. It reminded me of the title of Claudia Kunz's book a few years back, The Nazi Conscience. So can you talk a little bit about what this ethic they were trying to create consisted of?
Yeah, that is a very important question, and that is kind of that is closely related to what I tried to explain just before. The Nazis did not simply want Germans to unlearn or ignore morals. I mean, the goal was not that Germans would renounce of any kind of morality, of the sense of what is good and what is evil. That is not what the Nazis wanted, and that would be also very stupid, because I think if you look into all kinds of societies over the world and throughout the history, there is no society that can live without a sense of morality, what is good and what is evil. The question is, how do you define that? What is good? Yeah. What is evil? And, you know, we may be inclined as Westerners to just generalize or universalize our moralities. But that is problematic for a historian. And I wanted to show that the Nazis did introduce a moral system and ethics that was different than this culture, and yet would Germans allow to feel good even if they murdered Jews or other discriminated people. Okay? And the way that worked was that the Nazis would say, there is no universal goodness. That is the crucial point. There is only the only thing that can be considered as good is what serves or helps our nation, the Volksgemeinschaft. And this nation was a racially cleansed nation. It was a nation without Jews, without Roma and Gypsy, without Slavs, and so on and so forth. A racially cleansed nation consisting only of so-called Aryans, of Aryans. Mm-hmm. Only what is good, what serves, what helps our nation, the Volksgemeinschaft, what helps our nation is morally good. What damages it is not good, it is evil. That is a new moral system the Nazis invented and tried to implement into German mindsets. Mm-hmm. To a certain degree that they succeeded with that, but it has to be said that in the German society before 1933, when the Nazis came into power, and throughout the Nazi period, the Third Reich, I mean, it remained an ideologically diverse society. The Nazis did not succeed in eradicating ideologies and belief systems and so on that related back to Christian traditions or liberal traditions and so on and so forth. So, I mean, this new moral system, you might call it a racist morality or a particularistic morality, this gained some popularity in Nazi Germany, and it was powerful, but it never managed to conquer all German minds. Mm-hmm.
How does gender play into that Nazi ethic?
That is a very interesting question. And it has to be said that there is a not specific Nazi idea about what manliness is, especially in the first half of the 20th century. Maybe today we'd think differently about it, but say in America, many Western societies, manliness, translates into strengths, physical strengths, authority, power, domination, and things like that. These qualities are relatively well, if not relatively well represented by soldiers. So so it was in the Nazi society. The soldier was the epitome of a true man in that the soldier was able to represent power in various ways, including the power to kill other people, usually only enemy soldiers, combatants, people who are armed. That is a condemnation in all Western societies still today. And the Nazis said, well, true masculinity, I mean, they didn't say it literally the way I now phrase it, that's my way of phrasing, but that's the message they send. To be a real man, you do not have to be only tough enough to run into the battle and kill enemy soldiers and risk your own life by doing so on behalf of your country. You also have to be able to overcome these old moral systems, you know, the feelings of sense of guilt toward this, toward people who no longer carry weapons, POWs or civilians. Murdering a civilian is usually not considered as a manly act, but the Nazis said if you do that, then you overcome this old morality of guilt and so on, which we don't appreciate. And then, if that is a real real accomplishment, then you are a real man. So that is one part of the of how ideas about gender and masculinity did gain a new momentum in the Nazi society. Yeah. Another aspect is that includes also includes women. That's very important. That the in traditional societies of the 19th century, let's say, especially in European societies, where racial conflicts did not have the same significance as, say, in America in the 19th century, you could say that societies are divided. Yeah? Gender plays a role. Gender is a category of difference. A very powerful category of difference in that it robbed women of all political rights in the 19th century. Women in European societies did not have any political rights. They were, in terms of political power, completely marginalized. So they were powerless in political terms. They did get in Germany these rights in 1918, but they lost again in 1933 when the Nazis came into power. So what I want to say by that is that in the pre-Nazi European societies, especially in the German society, gender can be considered as the most powerful category of social difference. Yeah, that decides where you are on the ladder of political and in the political hierarchy, where you stand. Class is another category of social difference that also matters, but race is. In Germany there was anti-Semitism in the 19th century and in the 1920s, but I mean the Jews were politically, formally at least, equal to Germans in almost all parts of the society and government and so on, not in all. But race was not the most important category of social difference. That's the point. And now the Nazis came and said, all Jews are no longer citizens, and that is what the Nuremberg Law said in 1935. And not only this, they'll be killed. Yeah? They have to go. The Jews have to go. So that is that means that the entire system, that the social hierarchies, in the German society, changed fundamentally. Now it was no longer gender that was the most distinctive category of power, but it was race. What that means in practice is that any German woman, even the poorest one, I mean, in terms of wealth and so on, from one moment to the next was positioned higher on the political hierarchy than any Jew, even the richest Jewish man. So that was an uplift to all so-called Aryan German women. An empowerment of German women, which, you know, millions of German women did experience that, certainly in very different ways. But nevertheless, many German women, so-called Aryan women always, did experience this type of empowerment and appreciated it. That is also something, another aspect, where the Nazis changed the gender order of them, changed the gender order, and they did it in order to unite the so-called Aryan nation, the Volksgemeinschaft, to make all Aryan, always Aryan, I mean as opposed to Jewish Germans, all Aryan Germans feel united and to provide them with a sense of belonging to this Volksgemeinschaft. So it's always what you can see wherever you look at the strategies of the Nazis. It is a very sophisticated and very sophisticated and wide-reaching system of establishing inclusion, sense of belonging, through exclusion, housing Jews and other people. Inclusion and exclusion. That is
so,
the principle of the Nazis.
So let me piggyback on that, and so I've got kind of two questions in mind, and I'll start by the issue of inclusion and exclusion. One of the things you say in your book is that this community that the Nazis envisioned on a national scale, but also on a very limited scale of the squad or the platoon of the neighborhood, depended on, exactly as you say, having an outsider, in that in racial terms, that outsider might be the Jewish or the Roma or the Sinti, but on a local scale, that meant somebody who was not tough enough or not manly enough or whatever particular kind of quality that was espoused. How does that work? Could you say something about how that works on a local or on a limited scale, that the outsider helps constitute the community?
Yeah, that is also a very interesting phenomenon. The truth is that not all, I mean, that there was a hierarchy between, say, strong men or what the Nazis considered strong men and not so strong men. You know, you have that in the military or even beyond the military in, you know, youth groups or maybe even in a company. You know, there are the so-called weaklings. And the bullies, okay, or the alpha males or something like that. That is not a specific Nazi thing. But now you might imagine that weaklings, so-called weaklings, okay, what we call weaklings, what the Nazis may have called weaklings, that they would have been excluded or ousted as well, even if they had been Aryans, to a certain degree, that happened, but the mechanism that applied was a little more complicated in that the Nazis could not exclude unlimited numbers of people because they needed soldiers, as many soldiers as possible, and be it as cannon fodder. They needed soldiers. So these weaker parts of the male society or of the society at all were not simply excluded as so-called non-Aryans or in so-called inferior peoples like the Jews, as they saw were seen by the Nazis. These, let's call them, to simplify it, Aryan weaklings, they were kept within the group. They were included, but on a lower level. They were mocked at. Now, that's the same what you can observe in the military still today, or as I said, even in other, you know, even in schools or whatever, they were not excluded, certainly not killed, only in very few exceptional cases. They were left, they were accepted as part of the group, as long as they accepted by themselves or themselves to be the weakling. Why was that so? Well, this system that you have, you know, men of different degrees of manliness within one given group, a platoon or so, or you know, an SS mobile killing unit or so, that helps. That is actually quite pleasant for the alpha males, because the alpha males can consider themselves only as alpha males, as the top guys, if they have the contrast, the weakness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is this system. That is something you can observe in schools or in the military and so on. So it is not a specific Nazi thing. The way it worked out in the Nazi society, especially in the perpetrator groups of the Nazis, smaller units, platoons that were in charge with killing civilians, Jews and other civilians. Mm-hmm. The way this principle worked out in these groups is that sometimes, for instance, police units were ordered to murder a certain group of Jews. That is what happened. These police units included not only dedicated SS men, but also ordinary Germans who have not necessarily volunteered for their job, and then did face serious moral problems carrying out the order. It is interesting to see that the Nazis never punished ordinary Germans, police officers, SS men, ordinary soldiers who would refuse to carry out an order to kill civilians. There's not a single case known that such a person would be court-martialed or, you know, sent to prison or something like that. But what happened was that he was considered a weak. Yeah? One who mm-hmm. does not match the Nazi ideas about what is good and what is evil, the Nazi morality, no pity, and so on. These people were considered as weakling, mocked at, and so on, in the police units. You have to imagine these units operated thousands of miles away from their hometowns in Poland or Ukraine or somewhere. They were mocked at it. They had a difficult life there. But they were not killed, and they were often not sent home unless they asked for that. But they remained included in these groups as long as they accepted their inferior position, their position or their label as weakling. Because if they did so, they helped the alpha males and the fanatical Nazis to play their roles as fanatical Nazis and as alpha males. If that makes sense.
So the other way I want to piggyback on that idea of inside and outsiders is that what I find really interesting, among the many things I find really interesting about this book, is this the argument you make that crime was not simply a natural outflow of the perception of the outsiders, but was necessary to actually constitute a group for the insiders. Can you talk about that? Why was crime a requirement of the Nazi ethic?
Yeah, that relates back to this moral dichotomy or the contrast between guilt and shame culture. And what I try to say is, as you may remember, that these two moral systems can be distinguished ideally, yeah, typically, but... in fact, if you look at individuals in the Nazi society, the Germans operating in the Nazi society and operating, working as soldiers and so on, then you would always find that individuals, these two systems are still present. So it's not that you can abolish one or just forget about one side. And that is a conflict. So people who experience that conflict know that killing civilians, for instance, is on the one hand, the Nazis would say it is good, but the individuals who do it know it's bad. Yeah, so there's an inner conflict. you might expect, okay, people then run away or they get inactive. They no longer operate. Yeah? They no longer function. They are mm-hmm. kind of... emotionally or morally killed by that conflict. That did happen in some cases, but what happened more often on a large-scale basis is that Germans developed a sense of bad conscience. I mean, on various, on different levels, it has to be said. It would be wrong to assume that all or millions of Germans actually killed civilians or pulled the trigger when it came to murder Jews or opened the gas chambers and so on. Reasonable estimates of the actual killers among Germans at that time amount to a number of, say, 200,000 or so. So that is, in principle, a small minority, given dozens of millions of adult Germans, or even if you compare to 17 million drafted German soldiers, it's a very small minority. So we have to look at what is about the rest of the Germans, who did not actively kill. And with these Germans, the argument of my book is that many of them, it's not possible for historians exactly to say which percentage of Germans did what and knew about the Holocaust and so on, but reading many different diverse sources, letters and so on and so forth, it leads to the argument that Germans who wanted to know knew about parts of the Holocaust, mm-hmm. mostly the mass shootings in the East, the mobile killing units, also in conjunction with local collaborators, killed about one and a half million Jews in the East directly by shooting them. More were killed in the death camps, as we know, and the knowledge about the death camps was not widespread in Germany and among Germans. That was the Nazis managed to keep that as a secret. But the killings, the mass shootings in the East were widely known in the German society, even at home and so on and so forth. So those Germans who wanted to know and who did not just look the other way and close their eyes or their ears or whatever, those Germans who wanted to know knew about the fact that in the name of the German nation, a huge crime, a mass crime, had been perpetrated during the Second World War against the Jews and other parts, but primarily against the Jews. So this knowledge was present in Germany from 1941 on, through the end of the war and beyond, of course. Mm-hmm. And the point here is that you might say, okay, the Germans who did not pull the trigger or were not part of the concentration camp guards or something, they might not have felt guilty about it. But that is not true. The point is that they knew that this crime was committed in the German name, and that the rest of the world would look at Germany as the collective perpetrator of these crimes. And we have proof, evidence of that in letters or diaries of more sensitive Germans that would show exactly this, that the ordinary Germans who even resisted the Nazis or despised the Nazis, even more despised the SS and the misdeeds of the SS, even these Germans knew, I am somehow part of that society who did this. And so what that shows you is that during the last 4 years of the Second World War, the Nazi Third Reich, Germans kind of developed a very, very odd, very strange sense of national belonging, national identity, a nation as a criminal brotherhood, that was defined by a mass crime, by having committed a mass crime. Mm-hmm. That is a mechanism which we can observe if you look into the mindsets of ordinary Germans at that time. Even women, in some cases teenagers, and so on and so forth. But the point is that this grand community, the national community based on the national community and the criminal brotherhood included also those Germans who kept a certain distance to the Nazis and the perpetration of the Holocaust.
So why don't or what role does that play in motivating the Germans to fight as long as they did?
Well, they had pangs of conscience. That is what you can. There's plenty of evidence on that. If one reads private letters of soldiers, diaries, and so on, from about 1943 on, after the disaster in Stalingrad, you know, the Wehrmacht lost 600,000 soldiers in the battle for Stalingrad in early 1943. That was a sensational defeat or catastrophe for Germany, for Nazi Germany, and it could not be kept as a secret. So Germans knew about that, even at home in Germany. Increasing doubts among Germans came up, soldiers and women at home, and so on and so forth, of the so-called home front, whether Germany would have a chance to win the war, whether the Nazi propaganda on the final victory would make any sense, and so on. So doubts spread about whether Germany could win the war. Okay, occasionally there were still illusions that, for instance, that the Germans would, the Hitler government would develop and introduce any miraculous weapons. But that is not really what made Germans keep fighting, and that is a surprising thing. All the Germans, and including soldiers fighting at the Eastern Front, with catastrophic results. You know, the entire units, divisions were killed within one day or so. I mean, you would expect that the soldiers at that time would run away and give up fighting and so on. But they didn't. In part, they didn't because they would have been court-martialed then. But that does not explain the entire thing. If you look into their mindsets, as we can recover it or, you know, explore it based on private letters and so on, then you see that they actually were convinced of what they were doing. They wanted to fight. They didn't do it only because otherwise they would have been court-martialed and sentenced to death or something. They were convinced that they still were doing a good job, and they were convinced of that good job still in early 1945. Then in spring 1945, it was so obvious that Germany would lose the war that is a different period then. But until late 1944, early 1945, the soldiers did not lose their fighting power. The fighting, what soldiers call fighting morale. Mm-hmm. The fighting power was not lost. That surprised already the enemies of Germany, the Americans. They couldn't understand why would the Germans, I mean, completely irrational, why would they do that? They could save millions of lives by giving in, by capitulating, but they didn't. And they did not because they were afraid, the soldiers in particular, and the kinships at home, they were afraid of what the world, especially the Soviets, also the Jews, not only the Soviet Union, but also America, would do with them to take revenge of the mass crimes the Germans had committed in the Soviet Union and against the Jews in particular. That is something you can see on a large scale basis in these letters and so on. They were utterly afraid of being victimized by the victors, the Americans, the Soviets in particular. They thought, you know, any chance for us to survive is lost anyway, so we can just keep on fighting. That is what made the Germans fight, the pangs of conscience, the knowledge that they as a nation, not just as individuals, but as a nation, had committed the worst crimes in the history of humanity.
It's a fascinating book, and I just want to make an aside to the listeners to say that this discussion has been at a relatively high kind of theoretical or national level, but what's most interesting, at least to me as I read the book, is the wealth of examples and personal stories that Thomas uses to support these broader claims. And I highly recommend that you go out and read it. It's a really great book. But Thomas, we've taken a lot of your time. I know some of the listeners are going to be interested in going further. So I always give guests a chance to recommend a book or two that they might point listeners to. What would you say?
Well, what I can say is if you want to study Nazi Germany and the Holocaust or the Third Traitors, then you would find quite a lot of not so good books, but there's also there are also many extremely good books. I have this extremely good books. They're insightful, and you know, this is a part of it's a research stream that has developed and progressed over decades. It's a very far advanced stream. I have to say, I would like to recommend at least two, and I can recommend more. If you want to read a personal testimony, or if you want to read a very depressing document, well, that tells you quite a lot about the sentiments of Germans of their time, the feelings and so on, then there is a sort of autobiography of an ordinary German soldier that is was published initially in Germany and then translated into English. You can buy it as an English book. It's not too expensive. It is the author is Walter Reese, R-E-E-S-E-E, Ranger of Myself. That is a 200 or so page book that is a personal testimony which this soldier named Reese wrote down in early 1944 before he was killed in action. Okay, before he was killed in action, he didn't survive the war. And what he recounts in this memoir is his horrible life as a German soldier. First, that the Nazis drafted him, which he would not have become a soldier otherwise. He was a sensible person and so on, would have preferred to pursue a civil career, civilian dealer, book dealer or something like that. what the Nazis did to him and to his self, his individuality. But then also the book makes, in a very depressing but also enlightening way, clear how he got involved into these mass crimes. Probably the book does not reveal whether he actually himself shot civilians or murdered civilians, but he knew, and that is why the book is so amazing, he knew that he was part of this murder machine. And he reflects on that and thinks about it and writes about it. So that's a very impressive document. That is one book that I like to recommend. And another book that is a little more scholarly, but it is a scholarly book, that draws a much broader horizon. The author is Mark Mazauer. Mark Mazauer is a history professor at Columbia University. And he has published a completely different way, impressive book, Hitler's Empire. That, unlike my own book, which looks, you know, closely to Germany, Mazauer's book covers the entire European continent and explores and shows how the Nazis ruled over Europe. And he shows how they did so in very different ways. It's not, you know, one type of terror they apply to all countries equally. Mazauer makes this very strong case and exploring these different shades of the ruling over Europe. But what guides his narrative is a similar idea as mine is that the Nazis perpetrated violence and terror and so on, not only for destructive purposes, but they did so to establish a new order, that actually it was already called in the Hitler time, new order, Hitler's new order, the rule over Europe. And Mark Mazauer shows impressively how this collective identity and this new order was about to be established already during the Nazi rulership. I think it is written in a way that certainly non-academics can understand it, It's not an easy read, but it is written in a popular way. And Mark Mardauer commands an impressive knowledge on what he's writing about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've always been impressed with Mazauer's Dark Continent, which I tell my students isn't something you can read as the first book you read on Europe in the 20th century, but it should maybe be your second or third. But we've taken a lot of your time, as I said. So I'll just ask you this one last question. What are you working on now?
I work on two projects. One is a continuation of my studies of Holocaust perpetrators. Mm-hmm. I'm working on a project that would compare perpetrators of genocides, of different genocides. The Holocaust is one part of it, then Rwanda and Bosnia. And I try to develop further pursue these inquiries into what made the perpetrators do what they did. That is still a very fascinating question. A disturbing question, of course, for me, but that is what drives my research. Perpetrators in a comparative perspective. And then I am pursuing a different, completely different project, which I have started as a contrast to my dealing with perpetrators. I mean, dealing with these perpetrators, the way I do it, that comes with a certain type of empathy, not sympathy, of course. Mm-hmm. Some colleagues call it cold empathy to express that, you know, you can't just sympathize with them or empathy with perpetrators is a difficult thing. But I mean, if you need it to understand, if you want to understand what made these guys do what they did, it needs a certain type of empathy, which I try to work with also in my book, Belonging and Genocide. But I have to say, doing this as a scholar, as a normal person, you know, there are moments when you get depressed of it. And that is why I decided that I want to do something different, to have a place where I resort to escape once in a while. That it's a project that deals with beauty and pure body aesthetics and how body aesthetics, people's ideas about body aesthetics and how they practice it and what they found beautiful and so on and so forth in physical beauty, how that has changed over the last 200 years. That is what I am enjoying right now, apart from the perpetrator studies.
Well, you are a busy man. But I want to say thank you again so much for being with us. And I hope that when you finish your next study, you'll join us again. And I know the listeners appreciate it. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Kelly. It was really a pleasure talking to you. And I would be delighted if your audience would profit from our interview as we today.
Excellent. So thank you very much. Take care.
You've been listening to an interview with Tomas Kühne about his book, Belonging and Genocide, Hitler's Community, 1918 to 1945. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books and Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll come back next time when I talk with Bob Donier about his fascinating new biography of Radovan Karadzic. In the meantime, thanks for the download and have a great month.